Episode 2, The Pavement on the Road to Hell. Critical thinking question, and yes, that will be a continuing theme with this show. Those are the ones your teachers always told you you could skip for homework. And this one has several parts. Part 1. What would you think of a person who claimed that they had the ability to make plans for the life of another person that they had never met and didn't know anything about? Part 2. What would you think of a person who claimed that they had the ability to make plans for the lives of 10 people that they had never met and didn't know anything about? Part 3. Same question, but for 100 people. Part 4. Same question, 1,000 people. Part 5. We might as well do 1,000,000 people. And part 6. Why do so many of us follow these kinds of people?
Don't spend your travels on somebody else's highway. Do what you want, don't do what you're told. Follow your dream, don't try to revert to my way. Don't live your life for nobody else's goal. No, I don't give a damn about two.
Welcome to episode 2 of School Sucks Podcast, The Pavement on the Road to Hell. First, today's title references a quote that I'm quite fond of. There's a few different variations of it attributed to a few different people, and it reads, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions." And what we're going to use that quote to explore today is the perils associated with letting other people govern important aspects of our lives. In most aspects of our lives, we are constantly on the hunt for and demanding better things. We want improved technologies. We want better video cameras in our cell phones. We want thicker toilet paper. We want different flavors for our Doritos. And you know what? We want two different flavors mixed into the same bag. Options in the grocery store. Options to go out to eat. Things on television. We are always on this search as consumers. But why does this search suddenly suspend when it comes to the question of how some of the most important aspects of our lives should be managed by others? Or even better, whether they should be managed by others at all. As a consumer, you've probably noticed that most of the demands that I just talked about have been met. And even though I'm glad they've been met, the things that I listed were somewhat trivial compared to more important services like education. And as consumers, we should be aware of how properly incentivized people respond to our wants and our needs. As we sit there, flipping through 200 channels of high-definition television, eating our flavor explosion Doritos, resting easy, knowing that we have at our disposal the softest of bathroom tissue, why do we look at the way that our lives are managed by strangers and say, "Oh yeah, all that's fine. You know, as long as we change the strangers once in a while." It's weird, isn't it? So maybe we should try to apply this problem to something that we all think about more regularly, like food. Out here in New Hampshire, we have a sandwich place called Moe's Italian Sandwiches. Last time I checked, they had one item on their menu, Italian sandwiches. Now, this is absolutely okay when you consider all the competition and all the other options there are to Moe's. There's other sandwich places, there's pizza places, Chinese food restaurants, you name it. There's a lot of options for people who are hungry. But if Moe's Italian Sandwiches, with its same inventory, tried to function as the only grocery store within a 100-mile radius, that would not be okay. The other thing is, if Moe's tried to function as a grocery store, the only grocery store, they would, if they wanted to stay in business, have to start responding to consumer demand. Because people would come in thinking that this was a grocery store, they'd see that there was nothing there besides the ingredients to make an Italian sandwich, and they would say, "Hey, wait a minute, I want turkey. I want eggs. I want toilet paper, for God's sake, if this is a grocery store. And Moe's would have to respond if they wanted to stay in business or they wanted to stay competitive with other people who would want to offer that service. But let me just throw out a hypothetical here. What if this fictional Moe's grocery store started to enact the same business plan that I described in the last episode, where they're taking money from people by force or the threat of force to keep their business or their service running? In that case, I hope you're in the mood for salami. Now, public education, to be completely fair, is not as bad as this fictional grocery store example that I'm describing, right? Like, I've been to meetings in public school, and I see them trying to make attempts at individualization and accommodations and modifications for certain students. And there's also ways that you can get involved to have your voice heard. You can write letters to the people on the school board. You can attend PTA meetings. Or, you know, you could just stay home if you wanted to save some gas and lightly hit yourself in the forehead with a frying pan, which actually produces a very similar sense of accomplishment. But let's just pretend for a minute that there are some choices within public education. They are still choices within public education. That's important. Let me give you one more food analogy. Say you go to a restaurant and you sit at the table, and a waiter comes up to you and he doesn't ask you if you want to see a menu or what you're in the mood for. He says, you know what? You'll have the salad bar. If the person, the customer, doesn't want salad, this is a decision being made with knowledge that we all have when we go into a restaurant, that there is a broad spectrum of choices beyond salad. And that is even more true with the spectrum of choices within education. Going to public school and being told that you have choices within that school, or even choices between schools through something like vouchers, is like going to a restaurant with the most expansive menu that you've ever seen and being forced to eat salad, and then being told that you should be happy because you get to choose whether you want chickpeas or beets. So let me throw this out there as my answer to the public education question. What if there was no system? What if there was no system? I mean, if you think about the other means that people use to educate themselves, imagine if there was a one-size-fits-all magazine. Imagine if there was a one-size-fits-all bookstore, a one-size-fits-all computer. How about a one-size-fits-all website? This would be completely inadequate. But most people have come to accept the idea that this is not only possible, but preferable for education. Now, I guarantee there's somebody who's listening who's saying, these analogies are absurd. This guy's comparing education to sandwiches and salad bars. But I'm trying to illustrate something very important, and I'm trying to spark up a question in your mind. Why on earth would we ever accept limitations and these top-down, one-size-fits-all solutions for something as important as education, that we would never accept for something as important as food? And perhaps it should also bring up the question, has anyone on earth ever accepted these top-down, one-size-fits-all solutions for something as important as food? And if I answered yes, then you might ask, well, how did that work out for them? I'll use as a case study, if you will, the country of China during the 20th century. And I will admit right up front that this is probably one of the more extreme examples of the horrors of central planning. Between the end of the 1950s and the beginning of the 1960s, China's leader, Mao Zedong, came up with what he thought was a very well-intentioned plan to convert China, which was hundreds of millions of people then, from a rural agricultural society to a modern industrialized one. So Mao devised a plan that he called the Great Leap Forward, if that doesn't just reek of good intentions. To carry out this goal, for hundreds of millions of people in a very short period of time, like 5 years. The result was 43 million deaths from famine. Mao's plan was based on Marx's well-intentioned theory of productive forces, which stated that the government needed to intervene in order to bring about positive social changes for people. It's also very prevalent in Soviet Russia. So why do these things fail, despite such good intentions? I mean, when I say the great leap forward, doesn't that make you picture like a Tony Robbins book, more than 40 million people starving to death? There's a book I'm fond of called Ideas That Change the World by Felipe Fernandez Armesto. It's 391 pages long, and about 4 or 5 of those pages have good ideas on them, which says a lot about the kinds of people that have held power throughout history and the kinds of people who have had the privilege of whispering little ideas into their ear. On page 250, you'll find the heading Neverland and the subheading The Utopian Idea. I just want to read a quick snip here. The state always has an equalizing role to play in society. For those who believe in the natural equality of all, the state is there to enforce it. For those who do not, it has a moral role, leveling the playing field, redressing the imbalances between the strong and the weak, the rich and the poor. However, the idea that this function of the state exceeds all others in importance is dangerous, because equality enforced at the expense of liberty can be tyrannous. Utopians usually display misplaced faith in the power of society to improve citizens. They want us to defer to guardian dictators, intrusive computers, know-it-all theocrats, or paternalistic sages, who do your thinking for you, overregulate your life, and crush or stretch you into comfortless conformity. The nearest approximations to lasting realizations of utopian visions in the real world were built in the 20th century by the Bolsheviks and the Nazis. The search for an ideal society is like the pursuit of happiness. It is better to travel hopefully, because arrival breeds disillusionment or worse. In other words, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The road to hell is paved with central plans. And, you know, I would also take issue, serious issue, with the first couple sentences in that paragraph. The line, the state is there to enforce equality, I think he stated it as something that some people believe, is a completely ridiculous idea. The state is not a thing, right? The state, the word the state, is an aggregation of individuals, of people, right? So if a small group of people gets to impose their will or their agenda or their plan on a large group of people, that's not equality. Now, there's a couple of important ingredients in this recipe for disaster. The first ingredient is a very, very small group of people making the plan. The second ingredient is a very, very large group of people that the plan will be enacted on. And the third ingredient is the amount of disconnect between the first group and the second group. So then the ideal situation for one person making a plan for another person would be you making a plan for you. As the group making the plan becomes smaller and the group taking the plan becomes bigger, and the amount of disconnection between the two groups grows, you get closer and closer and closer to the great leap forward. And the end of the road doesn't always have to be famine. It can be a number of different things. Let's do an example from America, shall we? Now, central planning in the United States has experienced failure after failure after failure. And I don't want to go on. This could be 10 episodes right here about the failure of political solutions and central plans to complex problems. I'll give you one example. Urban planning. Middle-class bureaucrats and well-intentioned altruistic do-gooders visited urban areas in places like New York and Philadelphia and said, oh my God, this is terrible. Out in the suburbs in Westchester County, we have plush lawns and parks for the children to play in, and that's good for us. So what's good for us would also be good for these people. So What they decided to do was basically destroy all of these urban neighborhoods where everybody knew everybody, everybody sat out on their stoop, the grocery store owner could watch little Jimmy playing down the street and then report to mom if Jimmy did something wrong when she came into the grocery store, and she always came in at 5 because she lived right down the street. And they had these tight-knit communities that maybe weren't perfect, they weren't the most beautiful things to look at, and maybe there was even some violence or some unfortunate occurrences in these areas. But the urban planners came in, they destroyed these communities, and they built these giant concrete apartment buildings where they just stacked all of these former neighbors on top of each other. So people didn't know each other anymore. They didn't interact with one another anymore. And this freed up all kinds of lands to build nice parks. But unfortunately, they fell into decay because they weren't considered to be part of the community or part of the neighborhood that anyone inhabited. So they now are just where Big Jimmy sells drugs. Urban planning destroyed communities because they thought they understood what was good for people that they didn't even know. But at least in America, the politicians and bureaucrats and central planners have to pretend to care about something that's considered important to people who live here, which is individualism, personal freedom. And boy, this sure is an inconvenient obstacle to a lot of the things that they want to get done, but they at least have to pay lip service to these ideas. So let's go back to education. The education system that you took part in, or that you're still taking part in today, was not designed in this country, where the ideas of freedom and individualism are at least considered important. And remember, that recipe for disaster, a small group of people doing the design, a large group of people receiving the design, and a tremendous disconnect between the two groups, right? And let's add one more toxic element to the mixture: the lack of good intentions. The education system in America has its origins in a central plan devised by intellectuals in the now non-existent Empire of Prussia in the early 1800s. In the early 1850s, this central plan was transplanted, almost unchanged, to the United States by the man who is today considered the father of public education, Horace Mann. And unfortunately, it has changed little since then. So let's check our ingredients in this recipe for disaster. The designers of the plan were a very small group of elitist intellectuals who lived over 150 years ago in a class-segregated empire in Europe. The recipients of the plan, millions of American children who are preparing to enter the workforce in the 21st century. The disconnect should be obvious unless you feel like you have a lot in common with stuffy European intellectuals who lived in the 1830s. And what about the toxic ingredient that I mentioned? The lack of good intentions. One of these intellectuals, named Johann Gottlieb Fichte, offered this as the goal of the system. Quote, "The schools must fashion the person, and fashion him in such a way that he simply cannot will otherwise than what you wish him to will." The translation is simply this: the goal of the system is control. Control over how people think, how they feel, and most importantly, what they will do. And in 21st century America, we continue to follow this road, not really sure where it's ultimately leading. So maybe we can ask ourselves, where did it end for the Prussians? Well, by the 20th century, Prussia had become Germany. And after decades of this education system that taught them to be worshippers of authority, they started to make some very bad choices about the types of people that they were willing to follow. What I just explained might sound somewhat familiar in America, and in Germany, the rest of the story you already know. In die Maschine, Perhaps the most petrifying thing about the leaders of Nazi Germany or Communist Russia is how many people blindly followed them. I spent a lot of time today talking about the inefficiency of the public education system in America, or public education in general. But it does one thing very well. It turns individuals who would otherwise be free-thinking, who would otherwise be curious, who would otherwise be inquisitive, into obedient followers. So, just to pound today's metaphor completely into the ground, if the central planners are the pavers of this road to hell, their state education systems are most certainly the asphalt. People worship these central planners because they're trained to think just like them. Whenever I bring up the idea of getting rid of the public education system, the response I get is, what's your idea for a system to take its place? Well, I would never be so narcissistic to think that I could devise a plan to determine the future of 1, 10, 100, 1,000, or 1 million people that I had never even met. I mean, come on. I started today's show with a quote that I was fond of, and I'll end the show with another. It's by Henry David Thoreau, who said, "There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root." So this entire episode, for the last 25 minutes, I've been up rustling around in the branches and the leaves. I devoted all that time to making an argument about efficiency, that argument being that central plans do not work. But let's go to the root, like we did in the first episode. We made an argument that running a system like public education is immoral because of how it's funded. But all centrally planned systems are immoral, regardless of what kind of illusory good intentions they're wrapped up in. It is wrong for one person to think that they can control the life of somebody else, or of 10 other people, or 100 other people, and you can take that on ad infinitum. And if you ever meet a person who claims that they have the ability to create plans for the lives of total strangers, run. That is a very sick and dangerous person. But fortunately, in America, these people are very easy to spot. They call themselves politicians, and the Tree of Evil is their hangout. They're usually busy guiding one of two predictable and easily manageable ideological herds exactly where they want them to go. And in this Tree of Evil, the herds take turns. As one hacks at the branches, the other herd makes sure that the tree has plenty of sunlight and water. And every few years they switch, and on it goes. And we can pick it up right there next week.
So don't spend your travels on somebody else's highway. Do what you want, do undo what you're told. Follow your dreams, don't you try to refer to my way. Don't live your life for nobody else's gold, no. I don't give a damn about 2 weeks of paid vacation, about that money.